Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
My name is June, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
hi, I want to thank you very much for inviting me and allowing me to be a part of your conference. I love conventions. I think that they are a very, very special thing that is offered within Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the reasons is because it's one of those places where you can particularly see that we are people who normally would not mix, which I think is one of the greatest things about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you, with this tradition, this topic, I've had more laughs before this talk, and I've been teased more by more people, so it's been fun just even in that respect. The funny thing is that this, hearing about this topic is sort of like a game of telephone, because Diz's version of it is very different than mine. And then we had a conversation just before the meeting with Lee, and he has a whole different story as well, so it's kind of interesting. Now, this is the way I remember it, is that Diz, as he said, it's taken us a number of years, and we've gotten to know each other, and we've shared a lot of stories, and I consider myself sort of an amateur historian, and I love the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. It means more to me every minute than I am sober, and I just love having an opportunity to pass it on. So what I remember is that when Diz finally got me to come here, he said, now, would you be willing to do a workshop while you're here? And I said, yes, I would. And he said, if you were going to do that, what would you like to do it? You can talk about anything you want. I said, if anybody ever asks me what I want to talk about, I want to talk about the traditions. And he said, all right, I'll put you down for the traditions. And I said, Diz, you can't do that. I said, if you put down traditions on that flyer, I said, the only two people that are going to be there are me and you. I said, nobody's going to come. I said, you got to throw something in. You got to make it more interesting. You got to say sex and the traditions, or you got to say relationships and the traditions, something, otherwise nobody will come. But I was teasing him, and then I got the flyer, what was that, I don't know, a month or so ago, and it says sex, relationships, and the 12 traditions, And I have two spiritual guides in my life who are the most amazing, wonderful members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They both have over 42 years in the program, and, they're both two of the most enthusiastic, active, fantastic members of Alcoholics Anonymous I have ever known. And and I was telling them about this, and that's the first time either one of them have ever asked for me to bring back one of my CDs. they want to hear how I'm going to put this together. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, it's funny, I was thinking about that last night and this morning. This is the first time I've ever given a talk where I brought some notes, because I really do want to talk about the traditions, and there were some things I really wanted to mention, but thinking about this morning, and I just thought, I just don't know any way you could do this, really. I really don't. I don't know anybody who could, and I know some very talented speakers in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, but what I thought about was I was reading this spiritual book within the last couple of years, and I can't even remember the name of it right now, but it's something like, how to get the best spiritual contact or whatever. I'm just making up the title, whatever it is. And as I was reading this book, the woman who had written this book, she says in there, she said, I felt really bad about using that title. It was sort of like how to get a spiritual contact or whatever, She said, I felt bad about using that title because she said, I knew and I believed that everybody already knows and has everything they're ever going to need. They don't need to get anything. And every spiritual master that I have ever read or heard from has already said, it's not out there. We don't have to go get anything. We've already got it all. It's like Chuck C. used to say, we got to uncover, discover, and discard. But it's not about adding anything. It's just about clearing it away so we can get in touch with it. And so she said, I felt really bad about putting a title, how to get, it's like misleading, And so I thought, well, maybe that's what we're doing here. We just threw sex in and look, a lot more people came than we thought. So there we go. I don't know if this particular play, I was thinking about just a lot of things this morning, and I wanted to just, you know, like I said, I wanted to share ultimately about the traditions, but I was thinking about a play that I had the privilege of seeing a couple of years ago, and again, I know it's traveled around the country, and so maybe a number of you have seen it, I don't know, and it's called Bill W. and Dr. Bob, and it's like there's four people in the whole play. It was one of the most amazing, wonderful things I have ever seen, and I do consider myself something of a historian. I have read a lot of different things, and I've shared a lot of different stories with a lot of people. I mean, I was fortunate enough to know Sybil and her husband. Sybil was the first woman to get sober west of the Mississippi. She was the second woman, I believe, to ever have gotten sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She died with over 50 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. She never drank again after she came to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I feel very close to some of the earlier members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober in 1972, July 13th, 1972. Bill Wilson had died in 1971, so I did not ever have an opportunity to meet him. Dr. Bob had died, I believe it was 1950. So, you know, I wasn't even born yet, so I did not meet him. But to have met Sybil, who knew Bill very well, you know, was just about, it was awfully close, you know, in those generation things. But anyway, when I saw this play, there were certain things in the play that just touched me. And some of them I kind of knew, and some of them maybe I really didn't. You know, there were just two things that I remember, and I just wanted to share them with you. And I won't be able to share them the whole, you know, the whole story. For those of you who don't really know the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm not going to, that's not what my topic is. But if you can imagine, for those of you who might not know, you know, when Bill Wilson first had his dramatic experience and began to get sober and got sober, his spiritual experience, after that, he got sober and he worked with a lot of alcoholics. He tried everything to try and pass this on, and it just wasn't working, you know. And he was very distraught, you know, and at one point he said to Lois, he said, you know, I don't even know why I'm trying. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I don't have anything here. Maybe I don't have anything at all. Because he said, it isn't working, Lois. It just hasn't worked. Nobody's gotten sober. She said, but Bill, you're sober. You know, and of course that hadn't occurred to him. And the secondary part of, you know, what happened in the play, I had remembered that story. What I hadn't remembered is that when Bill left to go and work with Dr. Bob, he 12-stepped Dr. Bob, and then Dr. Bob drank again after that. And on the day that Bill found out that Bob had drank, I mean, Bill was just as despondent as you can imagine. I mean, you know, we have to realize, and I forget this, but I mean, I've just been in studying this history that, you know, my father died of alcoholism. My grandfather died of alcoholism in a drunk driving accident where a number of people were killed. But I mean, this is a fatal disease. And most alcoholics, before Alcoholics Anonymous existed, had absolutely nowhere to go. Now, I don't believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is the only thing that works for alcoholics. I don't know that. But I know it seems to work the best of anything that I'm aware of, and it has worked for me. And so at this time, you know, just one generation back, when my parents were born, there wasn't Alcoholics Anonymous even yet, you know. So this hasn't been around all that long. And so at this point in time, you know, Bill finally gets Bob, and they're sober, and then Bob drank. And Bill was so despondent. And he was just about, you know, to just give up. And Lois was angry. He'd been living with Bob for a while. He wasn't back home. She was working. He wasn't taking care of any of his responsibilities. And if you can imagine, you know, like Debbie talked this morning about the resentment of the alcoholic spouse, you know. Here he is. He gets sober and now he's gone. He's living in another state. You know, he's not contributing any money. You know, I mean, he's just off there talking, you know, to other drunks. You know, and at one point in this, you know, play, Lois says, Bill, I think I'm going to go back to New York. It's over. And Bill sort of ruminates at this moment in the play, as I recall, and tries to decide, should he go back and try and keep this marriage? Or should he stay here and work with Bob? You know, and it was like our whole future of Alcoholics Anonymous could have changed in just that moment. And Lois sort of said something, as I recall, you know, Bill, you need to stay here. Your work is here, you know. Anyway, and he did stay. Dr. Bob did, you know, get sober. And then one other moment that I remember in that play that the actor just portrayed it so perfectly is right before Lois leaves, she says to Bill, she says, Bill, I have to tell you that Ebby drank. And, you know, I started to cry that day. And that, you know, the idea, you know, I mean, you're trying here. This whole thing, it's like it was so close to not even ever happening. The guy that 12 steps Bill, you know, and gives him the basic principles that we ended up building Alcoholics Anonymous on, he drank. And actually, that man Bill always referred to as his sponsor. I hear him introducing him at a convention, I think it's in 1970. I'm not that good with dates, you know, I didn't write that down. But it wouldn't be 1970, probably 1965. He introduces Ebby to talk at the International Convention. And at that moment, Ebby had 8 months sober, and Bill had about 30 years sober. And he said, I want to introduce my sponsor, Ebby, because that was the guy that gave him the message. And that guy did not continually stay sober. So it's just so close here, you know, how we could or could not have, you know, gotten the message. I think, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about Alcoholics Anonymous is that, you know, it's been something that has been created as it's gone along. And so they were just kind of figuring out what works. And that's sort of how the steps came about. That's how our book came about. And that's exactly how the traditions came about. You know, I'll tell you this, you know, funny story. I was talking, and Nancy was helping me remember this this morning. We were talking with John, which was that when Bill and Bob finally did get sober, they did not know why it was that Bill had been able to stay sober 6 months. 6 continuous months he was sober. They were completely fascinated. And him and Bob would go out and they'd get more people and they'd bring them in and then they'd get more people. And AA was sort of growing, but they didn't know, why is it working? Why is it working? What is working? Remember, they didn't have a book. They didn't have steps. They didn't have sponsors. They didn't have traditions. Certainly, they didn't know anything. They just had these two or three people, and now four people. You know, what's working? What's working? And Bill had an ulcer kind of a condition, so he had to drink milk and sauerkraut because just to keep his stomach sort of going. And so they thought maybe this helped him not have a desire to drink, so they made the new people drink a little of this when they came in. So aren't you lucky that you came in a little later in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm really glad I missed the milk and sauerkraut. And in that same way, you know, as they discovered what works and how the book was written and our steps and the chapter, how it works, all of these things that came about, that's kind of how the traditions, you know, came into play. Now, just so I can throw in and you can say, you know, on the, since it's going to say on the tape, sexual relations, which we're going to go ahead and talk in a general way anyway here, but it, you know, just so that you let you know, I did try to look up sex in as many places as I could in the literature about Alcoholics Anonymous last night while I was in my room. And so if you want to read about a safe and sane ideal for, you know, your sexual relations, you can look on page 69, appropriately enough, of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it will tell you there that you may find, as you try to attempt to have these ideals in your life sober, that you may fall short, that you may make some mistakes, that you may go off the track of what you think that you're trying to achieve, you know, in that way. And it says some people tell us that we're going to get drunk if that happens. And they said, but that doesn't seem to necessarily be true. If we are really trying, and if we see where we've been wrong and we're going to go ahead and try and do better, that it's going to be okay. You know, I just know that, you know, those of us who have stayed sober for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, we know, you know, that there are lots of mistakes. And that those of us who have stayed sober, you know, I don't know anybody that I'm friends with in Alcoholics Anonymous that hasn't made a lot of mistakes as we have stayed sober. The thing is that you don't have to drink to start over in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can just start over, you know, but you don't have to drink to do it. Anyway, okay, so that was sex. Now, I'm going right into the traditions. And, you know, I was thinking a lot about, you know, number one, the first tradition, which I guess I should read these as I go. And by the way, there is this pamphlet, which I read on the plane coming over here. It's called The 12 Traditions Illustrated. And, of course, my friends were teasing me when they heard I was talking about sex. They said, maybe there'll be some pictures, so they got this for me. But this is a great pamphlet, and I'd encourage any of you who aren't, you know, who think it's like, you know, reading the 12 traditions is just too much. Too much material, not that interesting, it's kind of for them, whatever. But, you know, if you get a chance, just pick up and read through this, because I think it gives us a really important overview. I really enjoyed reading that pamphlet. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to read the tradition, and then I want to tell you a little bit about what I wanted to pull out of it. This is tradition one. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. You know, I think that, you know, as you read that tradition, and if you read this pamphlet, and if you talk to any of the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you think about this idea, before Alcoholics Anonymous existed, you know, most alcoholics did die. You know, it's very hard, I think, for a lot of us to imagine being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today, not having any meetings to go to, not having any kind of a group or any people to reach out to. And there are some loners in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous that are alive today, living in different places where they really don't have that luxury. But most of us have a tremendous luxury. I live in Los Angeles, one of the bigger communities in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have over 3,000 meetings a week in L.A. County. You know, so we have lots of meetings. And if I don't like a particular meeting or I don't like some of the people at the meeting, I have lots of other options, you know. But it really wasn't always like that. You know, and Dr. Young, Bill Wilson wrote a letter to Dr. Young in the earlier, I think in about the 60s, thanking him for his important contribution to Alcoholics Anonymous in working with Roland Hazard and explaining to Roland that no human power could do anything, that he was going to have to try and find some kind of a psychic change, some kind of a spiritual awakening, or there was no hope for the kind of alcoholic that Roland was. And Roland was to pass that message to Ebby, and Ebby was to give that message to Bill, and Bill was then to help write this book and to pass that message on to each of us. So that message being very important, Bill wanted to write and thank Dr. Young for being humble enough, as one of the greatest psychiatrists known in the world at the time, to say, I can't even do it. I can't do anything to help you. You got to find something bigger than this. And Dr. Young writes him back, and I had never really paid attention to this letter or the tone of it, because what he says is, he said, you know, it's not enough that you have just had a spiritual experience and that you have undergone an immediate or some kind of a psychic change. That's not going to be enough to keep the alcoholic sober. They must find, it's a two-part thing, and I never heard this part. I mean, I'm telling you, this is just in the last year that I caught this. It's two parts. They must also become a member of some kind of a spiritual community. And I don't know if that's because I have a strong forgetter, you know, where I forget things. I don't know what it is. But I really believe that therein lies the importance of the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, why I still attend on a regular basis and have throughout the years that I have been sober, meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I do believe that most of the time I am trying to go to a meeting and I am trying to add something to it. But in that phenomenal way that Alcoholics Anonymous works, I don't ever feel like I'm able to add as much to a meeting as I am given back from the things that are shared there at that meeting. You know, it's just kind of a circular thing. Now, I want to tell you about Sybil a little bit. Sybil and Biz and I have had a lot of conversations about Sybil. I met Sybil in my first 30 days. And she stood up there, and she had 32 years sober that night, which was quite phenomenal, I thought, you know. And she had been the first woman to come in Alcoholics Anonymous west of the Mississippi. And this made a huge impression on me, and I was lucky enough to really become friends with her and her husband. So this is what happened to Sybil. Sybil was an alcoholic woman in the 1940s. She had a daughter. And she was married at the time to a man who told her that if she disappeared again on one of her binges, he was going to take the daughter and he was going to go away and she wasn't going to have the daughter anymore. Now, Sybil was very different than my story, which I'll try and share, you know, later on tonight, in her alcoholism. Sybil fought trying to not be alcoholic. You know, she didn't want to do the things that she did. She didn't understand this lack of control that once she took a drink, she ended up in different cities. She didn't come home for days. She did not understand how this kept happening to her. But she was, you know, really at the bottom. And this had happened again. She had had another episode where she had begun drinking and had not gone home, and she knew she was in a lot of trouble. And she was an alcoholic woman in the 1940s, and she did not know what to do. And she happened to be reading an article. She was trying to get her courage up to go home and deal with, you know, what she was going to have to deal with. She read an article in Liberty Magazine. It had stuck out in her brain. But this particular day, she read the Jack Alexander article. In 1941, she read this article. And she stayed right there. She was in a Turkish bathhouse in Los Angeles, and she rang a bell, and an attendant came, and she said to them, please bring me a stamp, an envelope, a paper, and a pen. because she knew that it was going to be too hard for her to do all of those things. And I just so got that. Do you know what I mean? If she hadn't done it right then, and she couldn't just get the letter, she couldn't just write the letter, because she might have never put it in the envelope and never gotten the stamp. And I don't know about you, but I mean, that's an experience that I have had. You know, even in sobriety, I can like not get to the damn stamp. I just, you know, it's all these, there's so many things. So she got that, and she wrote a letter to New York. And she said, please tell me where I can go to your AA hospital. I have got to get help. And New York wrote her back, and she said she got back a letter remarkably fast. I just listened to the tape again this week. And she said that she got this letter back remarkably fast. And, you know, and here she was desperate. And the letter said, you don't have to come to New York. We don't have AA hospitals. She said, what we have is we have a group in Los Angeles. Meets on Friday night. And you can go to that group. So Sybil told her husband, and she was scared. She was very scared. She went to that meeting, and her husband took her to the meeting. Now, they drove into the meeting. They went inside the meeting. And at the meeting, there were men and women there. And there were, I think she said there were 6 or 8 members of Alcoholics Anonymous there that night at that meeting. So she goes into the meeting, and they're talking before, you know, and then one of the guys says, all right, we're going to start the meeting now. All the women have to leave. All the women were kicked out, and the door was closed, and the meeting began. Now, they kept Sybil's husband inside because he was a man. Now, Sybil's husband wasn't a drinker. But when he tried to explain that to the group, they weren't going to buy that story. And meetings at that time, there were one meeting a week, and a lot of these guys, we're all guys, a lot of these guys had driven over 100 miles and not good roads to get to that meeting. So this meeting did not just go from 8 to 9. They were not, you know, we save souls from 8 to 9 only. I mean, they were like, this meeting will go as long as we need it to, and we got to help this guy who doesn't think he's got a drinking problem. So the meeting was pretty long. Sybil stayed out in the other room, and she was just, she was shaking, she was sick, and she was just mortified. And her husband came out, and he wasn't looking too good either. And they left, and she dropped her husband off at the house, and she went to a bar and got drunk. And then right before the bar was closing, she started doing some of her best thinking, and she remembered that in that letter, which she had brought with her from New York, telling her where that meeting was, because there's her entry ticket, they had a phone number in that letter. And she decided she was going to call that guy up at 2 o'clock in the morning and tell him just what she thought of him. So she got out to the phone, and she put her nickel in, as she said, and she called Cliff Walker, and she said, this is Sybil, and I am going to have your job tomorrow morning. I am reporting you to New York, and you're done, mister. And he said, now, Sybil, he said, you know, what happened? And she told him. And he said, but Sybil, he said, we've never had a woman. They didn't know that you were the alcoholic. They would not have done that. He said, we didn't know. And he said, I wasn't there tonight. I was working. He said, but I'll be there next Friday. You come back to that meeting, and I promise you, you won't be thrown out. I'm so sorry. She said, well, I don't know if I'm coming back. And, you know, I don't know if I'm going to give your group another chance. And, you know, whichever. So Sybil had a big brother, and his name was Tex, and he was a big guy. And she was talking to Tex a couple days later, and she told him about what had happened. Now, Sybil says that she had bailed Tex out of jail about 89 times during the years because he was a pretty bad drinker. But Tex wouldn't drink with Sybil because he said she was just too bad. So she told him, she said, I think I'm going to go back to that AA thing next week. And Tex said, Tex had a farm, and he had a lot of guys that worked for him that were picking the crops. And he said, you know, these guys that work for me that are picking these crops, he said, I'm not getting all the work I should get out of them because they drink too much. He said, I think I'm going to tell those guys they either go to that AA meeting next week or they're fired. So Tex had a pickup truck. So the next Friday, Tex put all 10 guys that he hired in the back of his pickup truck. They put Sybil in the front, and they went to the meeting. Now, remember, there were only 6 AA members, so now they walked in with more members than the group even had. You know, just the second time in. And this time, of course, they let Sybil stay. They put on the meeting the way that they normally did. And at the end of the meeting, the guy that was running the group, Frank Randall, he and a few of the other guys went out to his car, and they brought in, the way I remember it, was they brought in a bunch of pillowcases filled with mail, like Santa Claus. It's like, you know, that. So they all came in. Now, these were all letters in response to the Jack Alexander article that had been published in 1941, Cries Out for Help. These letters were then sent to New York, which is just, I want to mention this because sometimes, you know, we have this idea that, you know, New York doesn't do anything, and what do we need New York for? And, you know, there's a lot of anti-New York and New York General Service stuff that goes on in the world. But this is exactly the kind of thing that New York did then and is doing now in so many different ways. So all of these letters went to New York. New York, and which was Bill Wilson, Ruth Hawk, and I think one other person, sorted through these letters and divided them up into whatever state or county or community they were from, and then mailed them out to these areas. So now Frank Randall comes in, and he's got pillowcases filled with hundreds of letters. And I don't know your geographic areas here, because I'm not from here, but I'm just going to make stuff up. Because what he did at the end of the meeting was he said, now, Diz, you're from over in Tallahassee. I'm going to give you this pillowcase, and these are all your 12-step calls. You take care of those. You know. And then he took another group, and he said, now, you're from over in Alabama, aren't you? I'm going to give you these 100, and you're going to do those. And he gave them out to different people based on where they lived within about a 100-mile range, and these were all their 12-step calls, that one person. There are only six members. You know, he's giving them all out. At the end, he has one pillowcase left. And he said, now, these are all the letters we got from women. And he said, Sybil, I'm going to give these to you. I'm going to put you in charge of the women. And Sybil said, well, I can't do that. And he said, well, why not? She said, because I'll be drunk next Friday. I've never stayed sober a week. And he said, well, you know, we're gonna take a chance, you know. And she said, well, what will I tell him? She said, this is my first meeting. She said, I don't know what you guys are doing or how you do it. Anything, you know, she said, I don't know what this is. He said, here's what you're going to do, Sybil. You're going to knock on the door. You're going to say, my name is Sybil. I wrote a letter kind of like what you wrote. And they wrote me back, and they told me about a group. And I've been there one time, and I don't really know what they do or how they do it. But if you come with me, we'll go back there together and we'll learn how to stay sober and what we can do. And that's exactly what Sybil did. As I said, she never took another drink, which is one of the reasons, you know, some of us think it's sort of silly when they end up with a lot of requirements about how long you have to be sober before you can work with somebody else. But anyway, you know, all of that, you know, that cooperation with New York and the unity that needs to exist in Alcoholics Anonymous so that we can have groups, you know, so that we have a place to go. I'm going to tell you one other Texan Sybil story, which I think is the most profound story about unity I've ever heard. You know, when I think about the St. Francis prayer, and it talks about, there's a line in there, and I think it's, you know, that where there is discord, I will promote harmony. You know, I will bring harmony. This is a line that I think of often. I think about that in my personal relationships. I think about that in the relationships with my family. I think about that line in relation to my work, in my home group. This is something that I am looking for, because I know there are a lot of times I can say something and I can stir up trouble and I can keep it going big time, you know. And sometimes, you know, it just seems like I ought to, you know, like it's really required almost, you know. But I'm trying to look for that and trying to say, is this going to help? You know, I have three daughters, and when they're fighting, I can see how one of them can say something that the other sister said, and it just makes the fight go on. Or they could not say anything. You know, and I'm so, in watching this, I'm sort of starting to see that I have an opportunity sometimes to add something that can either help or it can hurt in whatever context, be it my group, be it my family, be it my relationships with others, you know, whatever way it goes. Here's what happens. I mentioned that Frank Randall had that group, you know, that night that was passing out stuff. In the early days of AA, I'm assuming it was this way everywhere. In Los Angeles, however, it was definitely this way. I hear from Sybil and Bob Corwin, that when someone started a group, it was their group. I mean, it was Frank Randall's group. And Frank Randall ran the group every week. They didn't need anybody else. They had Frank Randall. So, you know, he ran the group. They hadn't gotten to traditions yet, so we weren't having rotating leadership so much, you know. And anyway, what happened, though, was they had this one night a week, you know. And AA alcoholics were coming in, and they were staying sober, you know. And these people, like I said, were driving 100 miles, you know, and just getting to one meeting a week. So as AA began to grow, they began to start another meeting. So someone started a Monday night meeting. So somebody could go Monday and Friday if they wanted, or maybe they could go Monday or just Friday or whatever. But, you know, AA began to grow. The groups were growing. Now, Text had a meeting, and I'm just making this stuff up because I really don't remember the specifics, but Text had a meeting that was on Tuesday night. And that was Texas group. So we got Frank's group on Friday. We got Texas group on Tuesday night. And we got, you know, Bill's group on Monday night. So now AA's got three groups a week. Okay, so AA's growing. Well, all of a sudden, one night, they get an announcement that Joe is going to start a meeting. Well, that's great. We'll have another meeting. Joe says, yes, I'm starting a meeting on Tuesday night. So, well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Text has the Tuesday night meeting. And there's an opening Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday. We got other nights that are open. And Joe says, I'm starting it Tuesday night. Well, Sybil is just horrified. They are going to start a meeting in rivalry to her brother's meeting? Well, I don't think so. So Sybil calls everybody she knows, and she goes, you know how Tex did all that 12-step call? You know how Tex has helped so many people? We got to get over there and support Tex's group. Tell them, don't go to Joe's group. Go to Tex's group. You know, we got Tex's group. We got to support Tex. You know, and I'm reading, I'm horrified myself. I mean, I'm about ready to, I'd be calling myself. We got to support Tex. I mean, I could just feel this. I'm like, oh, you're kidding. You know, I can't believe it. So anyway, this goes on and on, and so there they are. Tuesday night, and they all show up, and they're there really strong to let them know, we're behind you, Tex. You're our guy. And Tex calls the meeting to order, and he says, I want to thank you all for coming to my regular Tuesday night meeting tonight. It's really nice to see all of you. And he says, now, I don't know if a lot of you have heard about this. He said, but it just so happens that Joe started the meeting on Tuesday night. And he said, and you know what? That meeting is just about 3 blocks down the street. And he said, and I'll tell you what I think we need to do. He said, we need to walk over there and support that group. It's a brand new group, so let's everybody go over there and support Joe's group. And that's what they did. They walked over. They went to Joe's group. At the end of the meeting, Joe said, I want to thank all of you for coming over to support my new group. And he said, and I want to invite my group next week. Let's go over there and support Texas group next week. Now, that to me is one of the most spiritual stories I have ever heard. It's way beyond what I would have done. And I don't know where it came to Tex to do it that way, but to promote the unity in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and to keep it going where AA could have been severely divided, you know, in Los Angeles and I'm sure in lots of other areas. So that was one of those stories I wanted to, you know, to pass on. When we talk about the second tradition, let me just jump over there. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. And, you know, for me, you know, part of that is the trusted servants, you know, and the group conscience. And again, you know, that's another concept that I try and promote within my family. I mean, I am the mom. I'm in charge, you know. But I want to be listening, you know, to the group conscience of what's going on because I can be wrong. You know, I can be a promoter. I can be over-controlling, you know. And so I want to be listening to what is, you know, what they're, I'll listen. You know, I mean, and I want to be open-minded to that. You know, in the, I don't know if a lot of you know this, and I'm not going to tell you the whole story because it's fascinating. You'll have to just go read more AA literature or, you know, whatever to find out more about it. But, you know, at a certain point, when I think Bill Wilson was about 6 years sober, there was a movement by some members of Alcoholics Anonymous to have him voted out of AA. You know, they didn't want to have him in anymore. And if you could just imagine how it would feel to be about to be voted out, you know, of an organization that you had a lot to do with starting, you know, Bill was kind of depressed. And it was at that time in his life that Father Dowling came to visit him, and Bill didn't even want to get a visit, you know. And the guy came up and, you know, ended up becoming an important spiritual guide, you know, for Bill at that particular point in time. But I think those of us who get involved in service, you know, there will be times where we feel unappreciated and our feelings are hurt. You know, we've tried so hard to add something to our group and we feel like we've been, you know, slapped down. And it usually, frequently in my case and, you know, some other of my friends that have shared, has to do that we're kind of overdoing it. You know, we're not having rotating leadership. We've begun to think that we are literature. We are the literature. I was the literature person at my group. I didn't think anybody could do it as well as I. And I didn't want to pass on the commitment, you know. But it has to be this kind of rotating leadership. This one other story that I thought was really fabulous, which was that as I was reading some other historical literature, I found out that another way that this rotating leadership came out, it comes up a lot because we have some different personalities within the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So many, we are people who normally would not mix. And some of these people are, you know, they're gonna annoy the hell out of some of us, you know, as we all can probably on any given day. So there was one guy like this named Clarence Schneider out of the Cleveland area, and he annoyed a lot of people, you know, but he did a lot of good, worked with a lot of people, helped a lot of people, you know. And in Cleveland, you know, Cleveland was one of the first places where Alcoholics Anonymous was growing, separate from New York and Akron. And in New York and Akron, as AA was growing, when there was a problem in the group, or there was a disagreement, or there was a controversy, people could go to one of our co-founders. In Akron, they could say, Dr. Bob, what should we do about this problem? If there was a problem in New York, they'd go, hey, Bill, what's the call? Bill was like the referee. You know, what do we do here, Bill? But in Cleveland, there we didn't have anybody like that. We had Clarence Schneider, who people say was a little bit harder to get along with. And because of that, they didn't want him controlling what was going on. And so they thought, we got to have rotating leadership. And they made an important, you know, concept of nobody gets to do any job in Cleveland. Don't care who they are, how long they've been sober, nobody does it for more than 6 months. We are rotating. And what a wonderful contribution, you know, that ended up being to the importance of Alcoholics Anonymous for each of us, because we get this commitment, because we learn that we have to rotate out, you know, because it encourages people to take it who wouldn't want to, who are scared, who don't think they can do it, you know, whatever. These things, these service commitments, I consider to be the greatest gift that was ever given to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. The fact that I came in and was taught about the traditions and taught about service in Alcoholics Anonymous was the single most important thing to changing my life, more so then initially I could say any kind of a spiritual experience would have happened, because I was closed-minded to a spiritual experience. I wasn't here for a spiritual experience. I just didn't want to die out there on the, you know, I mean, I just didn't want to live anymore out there on the streets. I didn't even want to live in here, you know. But I just was looking for a way to not continue to live the way I'd been living. But I wasn't really interested in a spiritual answer, you know. That took me a while. And I wasn't excited about the steps, because I really didn't think a lot of this had to do with me. I thought it all had to do with them, and I was, you know, I mean, I had been hurt by the world and all of its circumstances, you know. But these little service commitments that I began to get, they were the things that were finally to give me a sense of belonging in a way that could keep me here long enough so that I could begin to hear about these other spiritual principles and begin to put them into, you know, into action in my life. The third tradition is that the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was asked to leave meetings. I was told that I was too young and that they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meeting. That didn't happen at every meeting I went to. It happened at some of the meetings that I went to. And clearly those people had no idea about the importance of the third tradition in Alcoholics Anonymous. I certainly didn't either. I was brand new. I was coming in off the streets. I'd been like every other alcoholic that you've ever heard about. I'd been thrown out of most places I'd ever been. So it wasn't a big surprise that AA didn't want me either. I didn't want me either, you know. And I didn't know they couldn't throw me out. But as I was to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous and to learn about that tradition, it became very important. And it's something that I think I rarely give a talk in Alcoholics Anonymous where I don't mention that and that third tradition. And I want to read to you very quickly, because in the early days, they were scared, you know, when Alcoholics Anonymous had finally begun to exist. You know, what anything, you know, we don't want to rock the boat. I mean, this whole thing could blow up. We could lose it all. It was very, very fragile. And they didn't know what works. What should we be doing? Who should we let in? What should we do? You know, and so this is what they write in Tradition 3. We were resolved to admit nobody to AA but that hypothetical class of person, of people, we termed pure alcoholics, except for their guzzling and the unfortunate results thereof. They could have no other complications. So, beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, plain crackpots, and fallen women were definitely out. We would, yes sir, we'd cater only to pure and respectable alcoholics. Any others would surely destroy us. Besides, if we took in those odd ones, what would decent people say about us? We built a fine mesh fence right around AA. Maybe this sounds comical now, Maybe you think we old-timers were pretty intolerant, but I can tell you there was nothing funny about the situation then. We were grim because we felt our lives and our homes were threatened, and that was no laughing matter. Intolerant, you say? Well, we were frightened. Naturally, we began to act like most everybody does when they are afraid. After all, isn't fear the true basis of intolerance? So, you know, I think about that, and as I read that list, I know that the number of my friends and all of my sponsors would have been kept out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and certainly me if they had kept that list of requirements, you know. So I'm very grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous kept it simple, you know, in that way. And I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to tell you one other story. I'm not going to get through 12 traditions, but that's all right. I'll get you started, and maybe you guys will want to learn about more. But anyway, this is my own personal experience that was just so interesting to me. Having been thrown out of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sure you can imagine, you know, how painful and how, you know, how that felt, especially after I found out that there was a tradition that they shouldn't have been allowed to, you know, throw me out. Although, in retrospect, I look back and knowing with my rotten attitude, that was probably a great way to get me to come back to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because, you know, you just try and keep me out of something, tell me not to do it, and I'm going to want to do it. So it may have worked in my favor. But, you know, in the years after I got sober, my home group at that time was the Monday Night Venice Group. My home group in the Monday Night Venice Group was a crazy meeting. It would not work for everybody. It was fine for me. Venice is kind of a crazy community. You almost have to be there to believe it. Most of the people at the meeting, you know, a lot of us, we didn't wear shoes when you come to the meeting. People bring their dogs. You know, people bring their surfboard. You know, lots of motorcycles. You know, it was just a very casual group. Ultra casual, and nobody looked the same as anybody else. You know, we were all unique. You know, which is of course what alcoholics love anyway. But it was a very unusual group. But when it came to when the meeting started and what was going on in the meeting, we were serious. We were serious about those traditions. We were serious about respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, that is just the way that it was. So, but anyway, now after I'd been sober for a while, a guy came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he started to come to my group. He went to most of my regular meetings. I went to 22 meetings a week for a number of years after I got sober, mostly because I didn't have any place to be that was indoors, unless it was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I really didn't have a place to live. I didn't have anything going on in my world. But anyway, went to lots of these meetings. But this is after I'd been sober for a while. And this guy came in, and everybody called him Catfish. And Catfish was crazy. Now, I'm not just, you know, we all joke about how we're crazy. Catfish was crazy. Okay. Now, Catfish would sit in the front row at my home group, and Catfish would put straws in his nose. And he'd have paper on him sometimes, and he'd sit there and blow the paper off, you know. And then sometimes he would sit there during the meeting, and he'd go. I mean, you know, this is the kind of stuff that Catfish would do. It was kind of distracting. I really didn't like it. And I personally, I wasn't sure if Catfish had, like, a wet brain, you know, or what was going on. Now, a lot of the members in my group, they were pretty kind and tolerant to Catfish, much more so than I was. I just tried to stay the hell away from him and his straws and his nose, you know, honestly, you know. And it was hard because I like to sit in the front row and he was in my row, the way I saw it. But anyway, a couple years later, after all of this, I'm driving down the street and I'm sitting at a red light. And as I look at the red light, right at the bus stop, sitting right there, is Catfish at the bus stop, going the way I'm driving. Now I'm thinking, did he see me? Because if he didn't see me, I don't want to pick him up, but I don't want to get reported to the old timers for driving by an AA member and not picking him up. Because I had all those years when I was hitchhiking or taking buses or walking and I didn't have a car, and you know, you sort of feel like you ought to pick him up. And I don't even like Catfish. He's crazy. But he didn't have any straws in his nose that day. And so I picked him up because I thought he'd report me to the old timers. So we got in and we drove along a little ways and we were having a little bit of a conversation, which I had never had a conversation with him because I didn't really think he was capable. He really wasn't capable of a conversation in those early years. And along the way, he said something to me about, you know, he goes, oh, you know, you're going to school. He said, yeah, my daughter. I was like, daughter? That guy has a daughter. You know, I mean, it was just inconceivable to me. Really? You know. Anyway, two or three times later, you know, in those next few months or whatever, I would be at that light and Catfish would be at the bus stop and I would give him a ride and we had these tiny little conversations. And anyway, and now it's 7 years later and I walk into one of my regular Tuesday night meetings, the same meeting that I first heard Sybil talk at in my first 30 days, and they say, and tonight we have a birthday cake for Walter for 7 years. And this guy got up there in a navy blue suit and a power yellow tie, and it was Catfish. You know, and he got up there, and he just sounded as good as any one of my professors ever did in school. You know, and I would have thrown him out. Do you know what I mean? I was thinking, you know, he's disrupting my row. You know. You know. So anyway, I mean, you know, it's really, I think we're very fortunate that that spiritual principle was brought in, you know, into the traditions to keep it really simple. I'm going to jump to the fifth tradition, because I want to tell you this one other story, and then I'm probably going to just, you know, stop. When, you know, the fifth tradition says that I'm going to read it, because otherwise I'll always say it wrong when I'm trying to stand up here and do it. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. So, you know, when I think that the most, I say this in all these different contexts, but obviously I think most of us agree that one of the most important things about Alcoholics Anonymous is the idea of one drunk talking to another, you know. I mean, that's really where it all comes from, and it has to be for fun and for free, you know. I think that that is one of the spiritual principles that makes us able to talk to the alcoholic, you know what I mean? It's like, because I know for me, if I thought someone was being paid to talk to me, I don't want to talk to them. You know, I'm almost still like that. I just don't, you know. But that idea that these people would be talking to me and they're getting nothing. Why are they going to drive me to a meeting? Why are they going to let me sit at their house when I am no fun? I mean, no fun. You know, clearly people allowed me in their home because they had been taught, you know, to try and be kind to new people. You know, because there wasn't any good reason to have me around in those early years of sobriety. I mean, I just had nothing to bring to the party that was good at all. You know, and yet they were kind to me and they were respectful to me and I didn't even deserve it. You know, I didn't even return it properly. I'm very grateful to the alcoholics that were here who were tolerant of me and the way that I was in the condition that I was in when I arrived here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Unlike the Al-Anon speaker who spoke this morning and just gave such a fabulous talk and talked about how when she went to that first woman to talk about Al-Anon, that woman reached over to her and gave her that hug. You know, I mean, just, and she hadn't had a hug in a long time, and that she tries to pass on those hugs, and it meant so much for me. And I've been thinking about this. I've been talking to Sandy, you know, about this. I've been talking to my sponsor, Bob Regan, these two guys I was telling you about that have over 42 years in the program. And I've been sharing about the fact that, you know, I believe that the speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous that were here when I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous were the ones who saved my life. And the reason for that was that these people, I think because they were speaking the language of the heart, they gave me the closest thing to a hug that I would have been able to accept. I was incapable of a hug. I wasn't even doing a handshake. I didn't want to sit next to anybody. I didn't want anybody to touch me or get near me or have anything to do with me. And yet when I could sit there and they would share about where they had come from, and where these principles and this program had taken them, I believed them. I believed that it had really happened, and I got hope. You know, and it is one of the reasons that I feel very privileged if I am asked to go out and share some of the stories that have been shared with me or that I have experienced, you know, in the hopes that maybe I can get someone to come back to one more meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous so that they can come to meetings long enough to start to practice the principles and the steps. Because I don't think that meetings, you know, meetings are not the program. You know, they're really not. I think that is the fellowship. But I was lucky enough to be brought into the fellowship, to be brought into service, which could then lead me to the recovery aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is critical, or we're going to die of this fatal disease by drinking again, because that's just what alcoholics do. And so, you know, we get to that part where we can't keep it unless we give it away. I want to read you this one part in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I'm going to just tell you one more Sybil story, and I'll sit down. This is from page 129 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is, you know, when we get into that spiritual intoxication after we've gotten sober and we've begun to get that spiritual experience, most of us, most of the people I've known, I certainly include myself, have had the slow educational variety, extremely slow, but extremely educational, I suppose, but in my case. But anyway, so it says here, we have indulged in spiritual intoxication. Like a gaunt prospector, belt drawn in over the last ounce of food, our pick struck gold. Joy at our release from a lifetime of frustration knew no bounds. Father feels he has struck something better than gold. For a time, he may try to hug the new treasure to himself. He may not see at once that he has barely scratched a limitless load, which will pay dividends only if he mines it for the rest of his life and insists on giving away the entire product. Now, in my book, I underlined entire a couple of times because I felt entire. Doesn't that seem like a lot? Doesn't it seem like, doesn't it seem like you ought to keep some, you know, just like a prudent reserve, you know, because then you'd have more. But it's like, no, that's not what this says. We got to give away the entire thing, you know, and then we are always overpaid. The one other thing I wanted to tell you about was in my group after I'd been sober for a while, they started to talk about how we couldn't have any profanity. We weren't going to allow profanity in the group. And I thought, well, I had learned about the traditions because I'd been a student of traditions. Now, by the way, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I only spoke in profanity. I had, like, you know, a few exceptions, the and mother. So, you know. Now, they are going to stand up there and they are starting, we're having a fight in our group about how you can't use profanity. Well, I mean, I'm not going to be able to say anything, you know. And we don't have rules. We don't have rules in AA. We all know that because we are, you know, the kind of people that can't have rules. And so now I think about this and I think, okay, we were about to have a group conscience meeting. And I know, I mean, I'm not as dumb as I look. So I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to call Sybil. Now, Sybil at this point had about 35, 36 years, and I knew Sybil was cool. And I was going to call Sybil and get the information so when I came back to the meeting, I could tell them what Sybil said with 36 years, which was going to help my position. So I called Sybil and I told her, and she said, oh, yeah. She said, we've had that issue, you know, when Tex started that first club, you know, the hole in the ground. So we've had that issue there, and we've had that through every meeting I've ever been involved in. I said, yeah, all right. And she said, now I'm going to tell you the truth, June. I said, all right, Sybil, give it to me. She said, now, Bob and I, she said, we talk like sailors over here at our house. She said, we always have. And I thought, yeah, here we go. All right, I'm getting my ammunition. I'm ready. And she said, but do you know, she said, as hard as it is for someone like you and I to believe because of where we came from, she said, do you know that there are some people that suffer from the disease of alcoholism that never went to bars and they didn't go to alleys? And they never got subjected to the kind of language and violence that you and I knew as a daily thing. And she said, so, you know, she said, when I think about the fifth tradition that, you know, the only required, that, I mean, that we're going to try and achieve sobriety and help the alcoholic who still suffers, she said, doesn't it seem sort of unfair in a way or wrong in a way that people who want to get sober from the disease of alcoholism would have to come to a place where they'd be subjected to a type of language that they never were subjected to during the worst of their drinking. She said, I know it doesn't matter to you or I. We don't even hear it. But for some people, they really do. And she said, now sometimes there's going to be maybe a minister or there's going to be a doctor or there's going to be somebody off the street who decides they want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. What is that? What is Alcoholics Anonymous? You know? And she said, and what if they came and then they felt, oh, I don't want to send people there because of the language. She said, now, I don't think anybody's ever left a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because they didn't cuss enough. It's possible, you know. And she said, and because of that, she said, I have tried, and I haven't always been successful. She said, but I have tried since then that whenever I am asked to share in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I try not to use profanity. And that has been what I have done since Sybil shared that with me. Now, I use profanity. But what she also told me was, she said, you know, we need to learn a different kind of language. And if we don't ever start to learn it, we won't learn it. And I'm so grateful, not only that I was taught that within the context of Alcoholics Anonymous, but, you know, because I have been able to practice that principle in other areas of my life. I have a job today, and it would not be appropriate It would be dangerous in my job to use the kind of language that I used to use, and I used to have no control over what came out. It was just such a regular part. And I have three daughters today who are teenagers, and I don't want to be talking like that. Now, that doesn't mean I haven't. You know, I had to call Sandy a couple years ago, and I said to him, Sandy, I swear to God, I thought I was going to make it until they got out of the house, but I didn't. Today was a bad day. It just didn't happen. I just couldn't stop it, you know. But for the most part, you know, I have learned that I do have some control, and I've got a bigger vocabulary. Anyway, all right, I'm going to read you one more thing, and I'm going to sit down. I know I said that before, and I'm sorry, because I hate when people do that. I really keep track. But I have to join over to the ninth tradition. The ninth tradition says in here, I'll read you the tradition, then I'll tell you, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. Now, it says in here, it's talking about people coming in and thinking, this is just so unorganized. I mean, there are no rules. No one's in charge. I mean, who's the president? Who's telling them how to do it? Who's telling them what time the meeting starts? Who's telling them when it ends? Who's telling them whether you sit down, whether you stand at the podium, whether you, you know, I mean, whatever. I mean, it's like, how does this work? It's pure anarchy. And so in here it says, at this juncture, we can hear a churchman exclaim, they're making disobedience a virtue. He's joined by a psychiatrist who says, defiant brats, they won't grow up and conform to social usage. The man in the street says, I don't understand it. They must be nuts. But all these observers have overlooked something unique in Alcoholics Anonymous. Unless each member follows to the best of his ability our suggested 12 steps to recovery, he almost certainly signs his own death warrant. His drunkenness and disillusion are not penalties inflicted by people in authority. They result from his personal disobedience to spiritual principles. I'm very grateful that you allowed me to do this. I'm sorry I didn't get through all 12, but thanks for being here.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.